It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Early next year, 200 Pittsburgh residents will receive $500 a month for 2 years from the city in what Mayor Bill Peduto is calling the Assured Cash Experiment of Pittsburgh. Half of the money will go to households run by black women. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey has committed $15 million to fund programs in Pittsburgh and about two dozen cities. Mayor Peduto has said this might reduce racial and gender inequities. That's the hope. But what has guaranteed basic income accomplished in practice? Dr. Stacia West is an assistant professor at the College of Social Work with the University of Tennessee. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
And Dr. Amy Castro-Baker is an assistant professor at the School of Social Policy and Practice with the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You two are co-directors of Penn's Center for Guaranteed Income Research. You both were principal investigators of a guaranteed income pilot program in Stockton, California. That program, similar to what Pittsburgh's will be, gave 125 residents $500 a month for 2 years. So what exactly is guaranteed income? It sounds like free money. Is that right? Stacia, we'll start with you.
In some ways, yes, it is free money. There are no strings attached to a guaranteed income. That's one of the key principles. And what we see in a lot of sort of social welfare programs are there are strings attached, right? So if we think about something like SNAP, you can only buy certain things at the grocery store. But what's great about cash is it's so flexible. So a family is able to make their own decisions about what they buy at the grocery store or if they spend that guaranteed income toward rent or a utility bill.
Amy, is there any sort of reporting requirements? Here's how I use the money?
No, there's not actually. You know, and as a researcher, it's funny because we often get asked, how do people spend the money? And are you tracking receipts? How do you figure out what they're spending it on? And we do report some of that information out in the aggregate. But, you know, as scientists and social workers, we care a lot more about how spending the money impacts people rather than what they spent it on.
Mm-hmm. We've heard people, including one-time presidential candidate Andrew Yang, really champion this. He called it universal basic income. Can you tell us where the concept originated?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, it's something that sort of picked up a lot of steam politically and sort of in public. Some of that has to do, you know, with Andrew Yang's run for president, but it really has to do, you know, far more so with a lot of activism that's been taking place and folks who are saying, you know, we keep trying to address the gender and racial wealth gap and poverty with the same exact tools. We don't seem to update them. And, you know, maybe it's time to think about this in a new way. You know, Thomas Paine pitched it at the birth of our democracy. It was the subject of Dr. King's last book. And it's one of those things that people have been working on quietly, you know, in the background for several decades. And it does seem like sort of an idea whose time has come.
Mm-hmm. Stacia, the Stockton pilot is nearing the end of its second year. So what have you learned to this point from Stockton residents who received the money? Have you been able to assess how it has impacted, maybe changed their lives?
One of the biggest takeaways that we have seen is that people make really great financial decisions for their families. So one of the things that we often hear whenever we do guaranteed income pilots is, you know, people are going to be irresponsible with this money. They can't be trusted. They're going to go out and you know, buy unnecessary items or spend it on leisure and entertainment, which I would argue are necessary items. But what we saw in the spending data were that people were really spending it on food. So I think one of the important examples of this is, you know, at the start of the pandemic in February, many of us were stocking up at the grocery store, right? Going on those toilet paper runs. For lower income families that don't have a predictable source of income, you know, they tend to go to the grocery store much more often, right? Which then would expose them to the coronavirus much more frequently than, say, a higher income person who was able to go to Costco and stock up on everything. And so what we saw was this big spike in spending at grocery stores and big box stores. So what that would indicate to us is that people were able to use that money as sort of a financial vaccine, right? Able to stock up in the same way that, say, a higher income family is able to.
Mm-hmm. Amy, what are you eager to learn about from the Stockton pilot? What have you excited, what you've already learned, and what you still hope to learn?
you know, a few years ago when we started this project, you know, it was kind of nascent, right? There weren't that many folks that were doing work in this space. And, you know, fast forward to 2020 and we have the Mayors for Guaranteed Income, Pittsburgh being, you know, one of those participants. And you're kind of like replicating this across the country. And so the first thing I'd say is I'm excited to see how what we've learned in Stockton is going to inform and move policy in cities that are really, really different than Stockton and in states that are frankly really different than California. The second thing I'm interested in seeing is just sort of how people's well-being has shifted. So we know pre-pandemic, 40% of Americans could not afford a $400 emergency. And what that does is it creates all kinds of income volatility, and that shows up as poor public health indicators. So that chronic stress, that actually shows up in the body. And that's one of the things that we've been looking at. And then, of course, in some of the other cities that we're going to be working with, even more so, sort of how their sense of self changes. Like, how are they able to show up for their family, for their neighbors, as people, as workers, in a way that they couldn't before when they're freed from some undignified work, right? So that's the other kind of pushback we get a lot is, well, if you give people free money, aren't they going to stop working? We have a lot of data that shows that's not the case. And if someone can show me how you live off of $500 a month, let me know. I'd love to figure that out. But what we do see is that $500 frees people up so that they're not degrading their health and their well-being, and they're able to spend time with their kids on the weekend, taking care of family and actually being human.
Stacia, you co-authored a paper, I believe it was last year, that argued social workers should consider universal basic income as an answer to growing inequity in the United States. Can a guaranteed income really solve inequity, or at least be a key piece to that puzzle?
It's a key piece to the puzzle. We always say that a guaranteed income is not going to solve every social problem that we have in this country. It's one tool in the toolbox, paired alongside the existing safety net programs that we have. Things like disability insurance, right? SNAP benefits, TANF. We imagine this to exist alongside the existing safety net.
Mm-hmm. And Amy, guaranteed income, what role does it play in reducing the inequity?
It's only one tool in the toolbox, right? And so it's often held up in public conversation as this one thing that will solve everything. But the problem is that if I give you $500 a month, no strings attached, that money only goes so far if there are also not policies in place protecting that income, right? Like protecting safe access to banking, giving people access to safe and affordable housing. And so it's sort of, it's a starting point. But we also see it as something that has to work alongside other policies and programs that will allow people to accumulate wealth and actually hold on to the money that they have.
As we've mentioned, the funding for Stockton's pilot and now for Pittsburgh's experiment has come from tech-affiliated folks. But what are other options for funding these programs into the future and not just pilot programs? Stacia, we'll start with you.
Some of these pilot programs, believe it or not, are funded with CARES Act money. So St. Paul has used CARES Act dollars to fund a portion of the pilot. There are other cities around the country that are looking at ways that they can incorporate pilots into their city budgets, or that they can appropriate federal funds toward testing out this idea in their own communities. There are a number of ways that we could fund this at the federal level, and it really comes down to the idea that a budget is a moral document, right? Do we prioritize corporate welfare, or do we prioritize the needs of American families? So to kind of put that more practically, some ideas have been floated around a data tax, and this certainly comes out of sort of the idea of this being funded by Silicon Valley, but essentially a data tax would say, you know, we should be paid for the data that we're providing to corporations that allow them to amass these considerable profits. There's the possibility of a value added tax or a carbon tax. So yeah, there's a lot of options on the table. It's just, do we want to re-knit kind of the social fabric of this country, or do we want to keep it how it is?
Mm-hmm. Amy, is it financially sustainable to have people receive a guaranteed income?
That's hard to say. I mean, the first thing I'd say is that there's a whole lot that we don't know yet about how guaranteed income works and who it works best for, right? So that in large part is the idea behind these pilots, is figuring out how to construct it. But yeah, it's absolutely sustainable. I mean, like Dr. West was just saying, you know, budgets are moral documents. And if you think about, I think probably the most promising idea is the data tax. And just for clarity, you know, we're not talking about taxing individuals for their use of things like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, all those types of apps. Well, is taxing those companies who use our data for free to then target us with ads. The American people receive absolutely no money out of that. We're giving it over for free. And so it's literally a massive commodity that's sitting there waiting to be taxed, and we're not using it. So it really comes down to political and public will, and who we are and what we want to prioritize.
So, Stacia, U.S. citizens got a boost from the federal stimulus check. Obviously, federal lawmakers have yet to pass another stimulus package, but given that it may include, could include another check, do you think guaranteed income is becoming more popular, or at least more upfront?
I believe so. And I think that is, well, the confluence of a number of sort of different things that have happened leading up to the pandemic, including the public conversation that we give credit to Andrew Yang for leading. We give credit to Mayor Michael Tubbs, Dr. Ayesha Nyanduro for leading this conversation around cash and helping us understand that it is a possibility that guaranteed income could become real in this country. I think that the pandemic has really made it clear how much American families are struggling. That families, you know, have been told for generations that you should have 3 months of expenses saved up in case of an emergency, right? We obviously don't hold corporations to those sorts of standards because we tend to bail them out first, as we are doing, again, it seems, in this kind of bailout package. But, you know, I think there are a number of things that have come together that have helped us kind of craft this narrative and this conversation that's pushing us toward an idea that simply as human beings, simply as Americans, there is a floor that we should not fall beneath.
Mm-hmm. Finally, as co-directors of the Center for Guaranteed Income Research at the University of Pennsylvania, you both will be helping the mayors involved in Mayors for Guaranteed Income. So what's your advice early on for Mayor Bill Peduto here in Pittsburgh? Amy, we'll start with you.
Oh, that's a great question. You know, the first thing I'll say is that one of the things that exciting about Mayor Peduto is his team. What we know is that these programs rise and fall based on number one, leadership, and then number two, having staff members that are committed to being rooted in the community. And so I would say, you know, to Mayor Peduto is to continue doing exactly what you're doing, which is prioritizing your people and letting the community lead. I think that that's probably the thing that excites me the most about the Pittsburgh team is that they are rooted in Western PA. And so having that research that is sort of really rooted in the community is absolutely number one.
And Stacia?
Very similar to what Dr. Castro Baker mentioned, I think believe in the people of Pittsburgh. It's one of the key lessons that we learned from Stockton and that we've learned in these experiments across the country. Let them tell their own stories and support them in that.
Dr. Stacia West is an assistant professor at the University of Tennessee, and Dr. Amy Castro Baker is an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and they are the co-directors of Penn's Center for Guaranteed Income Research. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Funeral services provide mourners a place to express the many feelings that accompany the loss of a loved one. But the coronavirus pandemic has changed and sometimes prevented funerals altogether. Cannonsburg resident Kathy Slunchak lost her mother to cancer this summer. She tells 90.5 WESA's Kylie Kozinski that while her family hasn't been able to hold a funeral yet, she's found other ways to channel her grief.
Jean was a Slovak and a Catholic, so I'm sure the plan in another dimension when this pandemic isn't happening would have been to have a full Catholic Mass. Is that right?
That is correct.
So what did you guys do instead?
Well, the week that my mother died, she was able to have last rites with the priest from the church at the Beloved Disciple in Grove City, where she was in the nursing home. And I know that gave my mother great comfort, and it certainly gave our family great comfort.
So your mom passed pretty soon after doctors detected tumors in her liver and pancreas, but you were able to visit with her a few times during her final week and on the night she died. Can you tell me how you spent those final moments with her?
We spent most of that time just calling her other three children and her four grandchildren because they didn't have the luxury of being there in person. And then the night that she died, my sister Michelle had held one of her hands and I held the other hand, and we just waited all night until she peacefully passed away that morning.
as you mentioned, you're one of five kids. You've got a few siblings in Western Pennsylvania, but two sisters. One lives in South Carolina and one in Texas. How soon did it become apparent that a full service wouldn't be doable, at least not right away?
Well, we knew that because of the quarantine regulations that Pennsylvania had at the time. They would have had to quarantine their families for 14 days before we could even do that. And secondly, the church wasn't holding large gatherings, so it really wasn't even an option.
You lost your father, Steve, 20 years ago. What kind of celebration of his life did your family put together?
Well, I'll tell you, that's why this was so hard not to have a service for my mom, because we saw how rewarding having a service was. When our dad died, literally 2 hours later, our neighbors were bringing food and flowers. And for 2 days at the funeral home, we had lines wrapped around the block. We had a full mass and we had a large luncheon. And we felt complete because we were surrounded by people and by love and by everybody that cared for us and our dad.
What was it like the weekend your mother died? It must have felt very isolating without those people physically gathering around
you. It was, because it was just my sister and I. And we were there when she died. We went to the funeral home. We signed a few papers. They let us see our mom one more time. My sister and I both went to our respective homes and we made calls and we worked on editing the obituary. And obviously we had lots of texts and phone calls, but we didn't have visits and the rest of our family was out of town and out of state. And it was just very, very difficult, very sad and lonely.
In lieu of a service and flowers, you had asked people to donate to the Grove City Library. How would your mom have reacted to that, and how did the donations go?
I'll tell you what, that's what makes me the most proud, because we really couldn't have the services we wanted. And my mom raising five kids, I'm sure she made 1,000 trips to that library. They were able to buy adult books. They were able to replace children's books and buy hotspots for the school kids in Grove City that were starting back to school. And that made me so happy and gave me such satisfaction. And I know my mom would have been so proud.
Another way you honored your mother is continuing a Christmas tradition you had done for years, sending a card to the nursing home. Can you tell me about how that changed this year?
Once she had to go in the nursing home 17 years ago, we started doing a Christmas letter just with pictures of her grandchildren and updating everybody on what was going on with the Christmas letter. And so typically I didn't do that for myself, but this year I did one. And I said, our parents gave us the gift of family, and I want to honor my mother's memory this year with sharing her family with you. And I sent pictures of all her grandkids and her great-granddaughter and a detailed letter about what everybody was doing. And I know my mom would have been so proud.
That's really beautiful. So what will you do when you and your siblings can get together in person to remember your mother?
Well, we talk about that because I think about all the people this year that died naturally and the 300,000 people that died from COVID so far. And I'm not sure that all of us can have services next year. I think that we've been healing and grieving in different ways. But I know the one thing for sure that we'll do is walk the farm where my mother grew up on, and we will scatter her ashes, because that really was something that was meaningful to her.
Kathy, thanks so much for telling us your family story. And I am so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
That was Kathy Slunchak speaking with 90.5 WESA's Kylie Kaczynski. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.